Sahana Vavatu, Sahanao Bhunaktu, Sahaviryan Karava Vahai, Tejasvinavadhi Tamastu Mavitvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Namo Bhagavate. Om Vaivasvataya Mrityave. Brahmavidyacharyaya Brahmavid Nachiketa Secha Nachiketa.
Very good. So we continue in is this still too loud? Actually, it's, maybe turn it down just a tiny bit. And we continue in our towards the end now. Thank you. Towards the end of this penultimate section in our Kathopanishad, and we've seen a number of verses which are functionally a Mahavakya. Remember, we said a Mahavakya was any statement, any teaching that reveals the identity of the individual in the whole. We've seen several such verses in the past. We'll see another one at the beginning of today's class as we go to the 12th mantra. And we'll just start right in. By the way, in the 12, 13, 14, in the last mantra or two, we have a very big discussion ahead. We'll see how it goes. But let's see these verses first.
Eko vashi sarva bhutantaratma. Eko vashi sarva bhutantaratma. Ekam rupam bahudha yah karoti. Ekam rupam tam atmastham yenu pashyanti dhiras. Tam atmastham yenu. He sham sukham shashvatam netare sham. He sham sukham shashvatam.
This language is familiar. I think a very similar language comes in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, another of the important Upanishads. The mantra begins, there is ekaha, one, vashi, one who is in control, who is sarva bhutantaratma, antaratma, the inner self. Sarva bhuta, sarva bhutanam, of all creatures. We've discussed this before. One self abiding in all creatures. We can go back to that bucket metaphor that we've used here and elsewhere. One, and how can there be more than one? When you come to understand the vision of Vedanta, it becomes so obvious that multiplicity is impossible with reference to Chidatma, the conscious self. Consciousness, as we've defined it, is unbounded, no edge, no limit. That which has no edge, no limit, no edge, nothing to differentiate it from anything else, no particular qualities to distinguish it from anything else. We're talking about a fundamental reality of everything. In fact, this fundamental reality we can talk about using very simple English language. There are two, in English and using English philosophical terminology, we can talk about two fundamental principles. One is that of existence. Everything exists. You exist. I exist. The chair exists. The table exists. The book exists. So even though you and I are different, the book and table are different, there's a lot of difference between all the individualities. But when I say you exist and I exist, there's a difference between you and me. Is there a difference between your existence and my existence? The manner in which you exist and the manner in which I exist is the same. the manner in which the chair exists and the table exists is the same. Existence, pure existence, is common to all. There's no edge or limit to existence. You have an edge or limit. I have an edge or limit. The chair and the table, everything has a boundary. Everything has name and form, which makes it individual, separate from one another. But existence itself is a universal principle. It is identical in all. Remember my guru using a funny English word, but made a lot of sense. He spoke of isness. And he likes this expression, and it's a meaningful expression. You, of course, you can't say you is. That's not very good grammar, but you are, I am, the chair is, the table is. The table has form, but the table also has isness. The chair has isness. I have isness. You have isness. And in spite of the fact that there's a great deal of difference between all the particulars, the isness is identical. That's one of two universals. The other universal is one that only you know about. No one else knows. What is that? Your consciousness. The consciousness present in this experience. That And what, this is what I opened my discussion with, and that is that consciousness which is present in this experience on examination, and it takes a lot of examination. It's not an easy examination either, but on examination, you discover that the consciousness which you call is yours doesn't seem to be confined inside your skull or inside your body because it's not a physical thing. Physical things have shape, have form. Isness doesn't have shape or form, and in the same way, consciousness doesn't have shape or form. That which has no form, has no edge, has no boundary, therefore is sarva-vyapaka, all-pervasive, common, universal. Just as isness is common to the chair, the table, you and me, in the same way, in exactly the same way, consciousness is common to the chair, to the table, you and me. Consciousness is common to the chair and table? Absolutely. If consciousness is all pervasive, how can you keep it outside of the chair or table? Consciousness pervades all. Big difference, of course, is consciousness is manifest in your behavior. Consciousness is manifest in my behavior. And that same consciousness is not particularly manifest in chair and table. So this is where we begin. Very big statement. Eko vashi sarva bhuta antaratma. There is one inner self dwelling in all beings. It is eka, it is one, it is vashi, it is the master, so to speak. And ekam rupam bahudha yah karoti. And that one, which is ekam rupam, which has, literally it says one form, but one form as opposed to many forms. One form here, and to call it one form is a little peculiar, but we find many peculiar statements in this Upanishad, in all of the Upanishads. Ekam rupam, one form, is a little bit like saying no form, no particular form. Everything else has a particular form. You have your form, I have my form, chair has its form, table has its form. But suppose we wanted to talk about a universal form. What is a universal form? We said that existence is a universal principle. Existence, sat or satyam. We said that consciousness is a universal principle. Chit, Chaitanyam. These are universal principles. Now here we see this expression, ekam rupam, referring to that same universal principle. So if it's universal, it can't have a particular form like your form or my form. It's called ekam rupam, one form. That one form is, I hesitate to use this language, a formless form We're going to come back to that point a little bit later, a formless form. That which has one form, that which has a formless form, bahudha karoti yaha. That one became many. That which was one became many. This is a paraphrase of a very famous Vedic statement that comes in several Upanishads and elsewhere in the Vedas and Upanishads about the one becoming many. In what sense? This isness, astitva, isness. How many? One. But then how many of us? How many chairs? How many tables? How many things in the cosmos? Countless. So that one isness somehow became many. Just as that one consciousness becomes many. The one consciousness becoming many, we've discussed in great detail. That was that pot metaphor. The one isness becoming many is a little bit like one clay becoming many pots. I have only one pot, but out of clay we could make any number of pots. One formless clay becoming many, many pots. That's what's being taught here. Ekam rupam bahudha yakaroti. That one becoming many. And these two lines together really form the Mahavakya. Because the first line is talking about antaratma. Antaratma is present. The inner self is present right now in your experience as consciousness. And what we've observed in many previous classes is the consciousness which is present in this experience is not ordinary as you might think, because the second line reveals that consciousness to be the underlying reality because of which this world of multiplicity exists, the reality of all. Antaratma, Satchidananda Atma, is then in a second line revealed to be the one that becomes many, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. Any statement that reveals the identity of Atman, Brahman, this is what we mean by Mahavakya. So here we see this huge vision unfolded in a very few words at the beginning of this verse. Just before we move on, it's too big to just skip over very glibly. Reflect on what this Mahavakya is saying. The isness and the consciousness we just talked about are not two different things. The isness, because of which the chair and table exists, is the same as the consciousness because of which your thoughts exist. I want to say that again, and I want you to reflect for just a moment on what's being said. I'll just flip it around. The consciousness because of which your thoughts exist, the consciousness because of which this experience exists right now, that consciousness is identical to the isness because of which the table and chair exist. That's a very common language way of expressing this grand truth, the grand equation of the Mahavakya. So that's what's expressed here in the first two lines. And tam atmastam, that one, which is atmastam, that which is in oneself, atmastam, in oneself. In oneself, in what manner? I can just share with you here. In oneself. Tam atmastam. Sva sharira hridaya akashe buddhau. So in oneself means where? We joked before, it's not in the cavity inside your skull. So then where? He says, swasharira hridaya akashe. Literally, in the space of the heart within your body. And we're not talking about the physical organ heart. We're talking about this poetic image. Remember, the ancients didn't have any concept of anatomy. I don't think they. Just a quick aside. How did we come to know so much about anatomy? There's only one way to learn about anatomy, and that's dissection, to chop up bodies, human bodies. And it looks like in ancient India that wasn't a very popular activity. So it's likely that their understanding of human anatomy was probably quite limited, certainly by modern standards. So when they talk about the space of the heart within the body, it's very much a poetic image to talk about that which is at the core of your being, that which is at the core of your existence. And then Shankara goes on to gloss it by saying, Buddhao. That which is at the core of your existence, in that space of the heart, it's your intellect, it's your mind. The seat of experience, correct? The seat of human experience is our mind. So Buddhao, in that mind, in that intellect, Chaitanya Akarena Abhivyaktam, that which is Abhivyaktam, manifest, Chaitanya Akarena, manifest in the form of consciousness. That which is manifest as consciousness in your mind. That's what's meant here by Atmastam, that inner self dwelling within. And Ye Dhiraha Anupashyanti, Ye, those Dhiraha wise ones, who Anupashyanti, who have discovered tam atmastam, who have discovered that conscious self dwelling within, anupashyanti, those who have discovered it, if you get a bad translation, you might get a translation that says, those who have seen it. And we're going to talk about that in great detail. I mentioned that big discussion we have ahead. But just to give you a sneak preview of that discussion, one who has seen it within. Well, what does it mean to see that one within? Anupashyanti, those who have seen or found it within. Is that found through dissection? You open up someone and you go looking for the space within the heart. Can you imagine someone physically doing this? It's ridiculous. Go inside the heart and find that space in the cavities of the heart, absolutely silly. So this anupashyanti, which can literally mean to see, I'm translating it as discover, but if you take it as to see, you're really in trouble. So you won't see it in somebody else. Can you see it in yourself? And this is the leading question for our later discussion. What does it mean to discover that one within oneself? Is it just going to somehow... So it already tells you where to look. It says, Swasharira Hridaya Akashe Buddhao. Where to look for that one? You look within the space of the heart within one's own body. What do you mean by the space of the heart within one's body? Buddhao. In your mind, in your intellect, in the seat of experience. So you know where to look. So you look within your mind. If it's helpful, you can close your eyes. But does closing your eyes really make any difference? If your eyes are open or if your eyes are closed, it really makes no difference. In fact, you can actually meditate with your eyes open. There's no rule that says you have to close your eyes to meditate. It's usually helpful, but there's no rule. But suppose, eyes open, eyes closed, you turn your attention within, where? Buddhao, in the buddhi, in the mind, in the intellect. And anupashyanti, you want to discover, just as they discover, well, what are you going to, looking in your mind, is this that which you seek, is it suddenly going to present itself and say, here I am, the one you're looking for, I'm it, here I am, look at me. Silly, right? So hold this thought, because it's actually, I've just made a joke out of it, but it's actually very profound and challenging. I want to hold off on a deeper discussion of this for just a little bit, but we're going to come right back to that. What do you mean? How did Ye Dhiraha, those wise ones, Anupashyanti, they discovered it. How? We want to discuss that, but we'll hold off on it. So, They discovered it, and tesham, for them, for those wise ones, sukham shashvatam. Those wise ones gained then sukha, happiness, but not just ordinary happiness, shashvata sukha, uninterrupted happiness, unchanging happiness, eternal happiness, which means it can't be an experience, right? Shashvata means unending, eternal, changeless. That which is changeless cannot be an experience because we all know our experiences are constantly changing. Every moment our experience is changing. So this sukham shashvatam, this unending happiness, cannot be an experience of happiness. It's actually atma sarupa, your true nature as ananda. We could call it the source of happiness. That's fine. Call it the source of happiness. Call it your own limitlessness, fullness, purnata, the fullness or completeness or perfection of the true self. But certainly not an experience of happiness. All experiences come and go. So tesham, for such people, shashvatam sukham, this condition of perfection, of fullness, of completeness, na itaresham, but this is not available for others. Itaresham, for others, na, it's not there. Only through the discovery. How is that so? If, just reflect on this for a moment. Consider two people next stand. Suppose we could put two people right here. One person, person A is enlightened. Person B is not enlightened. Okay. We're going to do a scientific comparison of the two. So, Atma is Satchidananda, right? For person A, the enlightened one, that person is Atma Satchidananda, correct? For person B, the unenlightened one, is there Atma Satchidananda or not? Identical. It's the same Satchidananda Atma. And that Atma is Ananda. That Atma is Purna, full. That Atma is complete. That Atma is perfect. So the Atma of the enlightened and unenlightened person is both identically full, complete, perfect, source of happiness. Then what is the difference between the two? Person A doesn't suffer. Person B, in spite of the presence of Satchidananda Atma, person B suffers like anything. Why? Person B says, this body is me. This mind is me. This body is full of problems. This mind is full of problems. This body is miserable. This mind is miserable. I am miserable, person B. Person A says, I am not this body. I am not this mind. I am Satchidananda. So in this way, even though Atma is identical for both, their experience and life utterly different. Therefore, na itresham. This shashvatam sukham, this unchanging contentment, is not available for the others. Okay, let's move on. Nityo nityanam chetanaschetananam. Nityo nityanam chetanaschetana. Eko bahunam yo viradhati kaman. Eko bahunam yo viradhati tamatmas tam yenu pasyanti dhiras. Tamatmas tam yenu pasyanti tesham shantihi shashvati netaresham. Tesham shantihi shashvati netare. You can see the second two lines are almost identical to the prior mantra. So talking further about that ekaha, that one which is, nice poetry comes now. Nityaha anityanam. Anityanam, among all things which are anitya, not permanent, not changeless, among all changing things, There is ekaha, one, which is nityaha, changeless. A very literal translation. Among all temporal things, there is one thing which is timeless. But now these words sound very abstract. What are you, temporal and timeless? These are philosophical kinds of language. So how about putting it very simply? Among all changing things, there is one that is changeless. That's really the sense of it. And what it refers to is this pot can have many forms. If I break it, it's going to be shards. If I crush it, it's going to be dust. If I break it and glue it together, it's going to be a cracked pot, etc. So this pot can have many forms. This pot can change shape. This pot can change its form. What about the clay? In terms of the metaphor, the clay is unchanging. So the clay is the unchanging reality because of which the changing name and form exists. In the same way, we're talking about the ekaha, that one reality, sarva bhutantaratma, that indwelling self, the one that dwells in all beings. That ekaha, that one, is nityaha, that which is unchanging, anityanam, among all changing things. It is chetanaha, chetananam. For chetananam, for all conscious things, it is chetana. It is the consciousness of all things. In fact, this really goes to what our introduction was. We talked about those two universal principles, isness and consciousness. That which is the unchanging truth for all changing things, isness. The unchanging substratum, because of which all changing things exist, is that isness, sat or satyam. And then the next statement, chetanaha, chetananam. For all conscious beings, what is the consciousness? That one is the source of consciousness for all conscious beings. Just like that one sun shining in all the buckets, one consciousness. So here we have those two principles, isness and the consciousness. Isness, sat, consciousness, chit. And that isness and consciousness have no limit or boundary, ananda, sat, chit, ananda. It is ekaha bahunam. It is the one because of which the many exist. Bahunam, for the many. For the many forms of existence, it is ekaha, the one. So as we've said before, for the chair, for the table, for you, for me, for the countless forms in the world, that one underlying reality, substratum of existence, is the one we're talking about, that ekaha. And it is one yaha vidadhati kaman. The one, yaha, the one who, vidadhati, establishes, creates, kaman. And here, kaman literally desires, but in context, there's several ways of taking it. I think a clear way of taking it is as your own thoughts. Kama, desire, but desire means in the form of thoughts. What is the source of thoughts? How is it that thoughts arise? This pot arises because of that one clay. In the same way, the chair, table, you and me, we exist because of that same underlying reality. What about thoughts? Thoughts exist because of what? Pot exists because of clay. The chair and table exist because of this isness. And we could certainly say that thoughts exist because of consciousness, that second principle. That isness and consciousness, as we just observed, these are not two different entities or realities. It's one and the same reality. Notice that expression, sat chit ananda, describing that the essence of Atma is simultaneously sat and chit. Similarly, the expression for Brahman, the expression from the Taittiriya Upanishad, Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam, Brahma, parallel expression, that Brahman is Satyam and Jnanam. Jnanam here means Chit, Chaitanya, consciousness. So that Brahman is simultaneously Satyam, isness, and Jnanam, consciousness. Just as Atma is simultaneously Sat, isness, and Chit, consciousness. These words are not qualities. It doesn't mean that Atma has, just to sound silly, Atma has some Sat, some Chit, and a little bit of Ananda. These words are not qualities. These words describe what Atma is. They reveal the Swarupa of Atma. So please don't get confused. This, by the way, is a source of confusion. Are these qualities, you know, and just to return to a discussion we've had here before, is consciousness something you possess? If consciousness is a quality, you can possess consciousness. Qualities we possess. We possess qualities like male and female. We possess qualities like short and tall. We possess all of these qualities. That which you possess is a quality. Now, if a quality can change, not if, a quality can change and you still exist, right? Suppose you are overweight. And then you lose a lot of weight. So first your quality was, pardon the language, your quality was fat. Then you lose a lot of weight, and now your quality is thin. Your qualities have changed. You used to be fat, now you're thin. But you still exist. Qualities can change. You still exist because qualities. Qualities are not you. You are the possessor of the qualities. The qualities are not you. Watch this. Suppose we treat consciousness as a quality. If consciousness is a quality, suppose it changes. How would consciousness change? Well, the only way it can change from consciousness to unconsciousness. Really, that's the main change. You're either conscious or you're not. So consciousness changes to unconsciousness. You change from fat to thin, but you still exist. If you change from a conscious being to an unconscious being, does your existence have any meaning? You get the point. Consciousness is not a quality. It's not something you possess. It's who you are. Just as isness is not something you possess. Isness and consciousness is your swarupa, your true nature, not qualities or characteristics. Okay, so this ekaha bahunam, the one because of which many exists, yaha vididhati, it is that which creates, it is a source of kaman, of desires literally, but it means of all thoughts, all mental activities. And the last part is almost identical as what we saw, tam atmas tam, that one which is atmas tam, abiding within, we said buddhau, Shankaracharya said, in the mind, in the buddhi. Ye anupashyanti dhiraha. Ye dhiraha, those wise ones who anupashyanti, and that's the word we're going to come back to. They see it. They discover it. And we want to find out how do they see it? How do they discover it? We'll come to that in a minute. But tesham, for them, shantihi shashvati. They gain shashvati shantihi. They gain eternal shanti. The prior verse said, shashvatam sukham, unchanging happiness. Now we have shashvati shantihi, unchanging shanti. Same thing, same meaning. There's actually an interesting connection between shanti and sukha that's not very obvious. Everyone wants happiness. Shanti doesn't mean happiness. And the literal, the etymological meaning of shanti is not even peace. I mean, it means peace in most contexts, but we've discussed here before that it comes from the root shum, which means quiet. And a very, very precise interpretation of the word shanti could be silence. So, shashvati shantihi, eternal silence. Wait a minute. In English, what do we use that expression for? Eternal silence. And is a meta is used in the English language for death. We have all these expressions for dying. Eternal silence. Even eternal peace can be used in that sense. Now, the irony, and you're all experienced meditators, I'm sure, the irony becomes very clear, and that is when your mind becomes quiet, or I should say to the extent that your mind becomes quiet, how do you feel? It feels really good, right? It feels really good. Are the thermostats set to 68? Yeah. Okay, there we go. It just turned off. It read my mind. Good. Thanks. Isn't that ironic that when you're, to the extent that your mind becomes quiet, you experience sukha, contentment, happiness. It's what you want, you discover in a silent mind. So in this way, shanti and sukha are not talking about two different things. They're talking really about your true nature. You, minus your body, try this. Minus your body, by the way, that's not such an unusual thing. You minus your body, every night when you sleep, you're minus your body. When you dream, you're minus your body. You have a whole dream world. You have a whole dream life going on in your dreams. You do all kinds of stuff in your dream. You manage very well without a physical body, correct? So the idea of having a bodiless existence is not so strange. So just do this mental experiment with me. You minus your body, you minus sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell. No problem, right? Do you have any suffering? You minus your body, like in a dream, no problem. If you close your eyes and you don't hear anything, you don't smell or taste anything, no problem, right? Then you minus emotions. And given the fact that many of our emotions are unpleasant, that's not such a bad thing. Some of our emotions are very pleasant. Many of them are not so pleasant. So you minus emotions, that's not so terrible. Be boring maybe, but you minus your soul. Again, our mental experiment. You, minus your body, minus sight, hearing, taste, smell, touch. You, minus your emotions. You, minus thoughts. Any problem? What's left? What's left is you. We've just talked about getting rid of all the things that you possess, body, mind, senses, etc. What's left is you. And the you that is left is full, complete, limitless, content, peaceful. It's what we want. All right. And that's expressed in the prior verse by Shashvatam Sukham. And in this verse by Shashvati Shantihi. All right. Now, we can go to the next verse, and this is going to introduce our big question of the night. The question of the night is introduced not by me, but it's introduced by Nachiketas. Hey, remember Nachiketas? So, the 14th mantra is a question of Nachiketas.
Tadhe tadati manyante, anirdesham paramam sukham, katham nu tad vijaniyam, kimu bhati vibhati.
So this is Nachiketa's question now to Yama. A little complicated. Tat etat iti manyante anirdesham paramam sukham. Start at the end. Paramam sukham. We're not talking about any kind of sukha. We're talking about paramasukha. The expression came before was shashvatam sukham. Now the expression we have is paramam sukham, which means, just as we said before, this is not a sukha that you experience. It's not an experience, as we said before. Experience comes and goes. Here, to distinguish it, the word used is paramam, usually translated as supreme. Supreme happiness is not a lot of happiness. Right? It's not just a more intense variety of happiness. Let's be very clear. Ananda is not a more intense form of happiness. These, in our Vedantic terminology, when we use expressions like paramam sukham or ananda, we're talking about something which is completely unlike experiential happiness. It is not a mass quantity of experiential happiness, not at all. Rather, it's a completely different thing, as it were. What kind of different thing? Paramam sukham. If you say, what exactly is that parama sukha? Ordinary sukha, we know. We know food sukha. The happiness we get from food. We know the happiness we get from friends and families. We know the sukha we get from all kinds of pleasant experiences. What do you know about paramasukha? Anirdeshyam. Can't be explained. We can describe ordinary sukha, but this paramasukha, we have no words to describe it, no language to describe it, because it's not an experience. We can describe our experiences, but the paramasukha we're talking about is not an experience. It is anirdeshyam. So that which is anirdeshyam, and that pronoun at the very beginning, tat. Tat anirdeshyam. We have to connect these words which are far apart. Tat anirdeshyam. That paramasukham. The English words doesn't sound right. Tat paramam sukham. That supreme happiness, which is anirdeshyam, which cannot be expressed in words. Etat iti manyante. Iti manyante, there are those who consider, the enlightened ones, who consider that inexplicable happiness, they consider to be etat. And you have to know a little bit of grammar to understand this. Tat is the remote pronoun, that. Etat is the near pronoun, the proximate pronoun, this. We use a pronoun that for what is remote to your experience. We use a pronoun this for what is in your experience. Now, a very subtle usage of this grammar here. You really, without knowing the grammar, you couldn't really get the sense of this line. So, tat anirdeshyam, that which is inexplicable, that which cannot be described, etat iti manyante. There are those who consider it to be this, which means they consider it to be present in one's experience. That which is tat, remote, that which is anirdeshyam, that which can't be explained in words, that paramam sukham, that goal which everyone seeks, which is remote, which is inexplicable in words, iti manyante, thus they think, a tat. It is not a that, it is a this. It's a very nice way of putting it. Here's a good way to find out someone who's clueless about Vedanta. And if they use language like this, the Atma is said to be Satchidananda. Look at the expression in English. The Atma. Is Atma a the? If you understand any Vedanta at all, you know that you can't use that expression. There is no the Atma. I am that Atma. So the very use of the expression the Atma demonstrates someone who doesn't get it. In the same way, one who says tat anirdesham, that which is remote, that which is inexplicable, that paramam sukham, we're talking about someone who doesn't get it. On the other hand, etat iti manyante, there are those who consider to be not a remote that, but an immediately present this. So that first line is a little subtle. So this is Nachiketa's lead into the question. That which is considered unknowable and remote by most people, there are some enlightened ones, I'm paraphrasing, there are some enlightened ones who consider to be knowable, who consider to be immediately present in one's experience. And so Nachiketas raises his question. He says, katam nu tadvijaniyam, katam, how, nu, indeed, tat, that one, that which is remote, that which is inexplicable, tatvijaniyam, katam, how can I know it? If you say it's inexplicable, if you say it's remote, if you say it's beyond experience, katam vijaniyam, how can I know that one? How can I know the unknowable? Nachiketas has a good question. He further, kim ubhati, does that one, and here we get into the real thick part of the question, kim ubhati, does that one bhati shine, vibhati va, or does it appear? Huh? Does that one shine, or does it appear? And that's literally what the verse says. Shankara makes it much more clear. He says, kimu tad bhati, does that one shine? Dipyate, like a lamp, like a shining lamp. Prakashatmakam tat. Is it a shining presence? So we're talking about that one. To go back to the first verse, sarva bhuta antaratma, that inner self dwelling within all, does it bhati, does it shine, is it prakashatmakam, is it self-shining like a lamp, or vibhati? And what does vibhati mean? Vibhati literally means to appear, and Shankara explains, asmad buddhi gocharatvena vibhati vispashtam drishyate. Asmad buddhi, in our minds, that gocharatvena, accessible to our minds, vibhati, that which appears, being grasped by our minds, vispashtam drishyate, being clearly seen or perceived. That's what he means by appear. So that which we're seeking, is it something shining in our minds, or is it something that appears in our minds? Now, I've taken you through the language, and now we have to get a little bit more clear about this. What we're discussing, or what we're just beginning, and we'll introduce the question right now, and the very challenging subject matter. What is the actual mechanism through which one gains self-knowledge? Big question. And we'll start by a very easy example. How do you gain knowledge of a pot? Well, I mean, the first part is pretty obvious. Your eyes see the pot. It brings to your mind the form of pot. And in your mind is a vritti in the form of a pot. This is a little bit of a technical discussion. I don't think you get bored, however, because this one relates so directly to our experience and is so crucial to understanding how Atmajnanam, self-knowledge. How does it take place? So even though it's technical, I think you're going to find it quite helpful and interesting. But because it's technical, we need to develop a bit of a framework for our discussion. So I want to introduce some terms. We're going to discuss the process of knowing as having two phases, two steps. In the first phase or step, the vritti takes the form of object. So with the help of your eyes and all the other mechanics going on, you see the pot, and the result of seeing the pot is a vritti in the form of a pot. A vritti in the form of a pot. And I'm not doing this trivially. It's going to end up being important, but look at the term I'm giving you. Gata akara vritti. Gata akara vritti. A vritti in the form, akara, in the form of a gata, which is a Sanskrit word for pot. A gata akara vritti is a thought in the form of a pot. And this is the first of the two steps in gaining knowledge of the pot. And this is not sufficient. If there were a thought in the form of a pot in your mind, and you were somehow not paying attention to it, you wouldn't know it. There's a second step, and that is the vritti is known to you. These are the two. First step is the vritti in the form of the object comes. So first step is the arising of the vritti, but we can distinguish a second connected step, and that is that the vritti is known to you. There are two ways of describing the knownness of the vritti. One way would be to say that the vritti is illumined by your consciousness. We've used that metaphor many times. The vritti arises in your mind, and the vritti is illumined by consciousness. Or alternatively, we could say that the vritti is a form superimposed on consciousness. So we could say that the vritti is pervaded by consciousness. In either case, that vritti is illumined by consciousness, that vritti is pervaded by consciousness, that vritti is conscious. I mean, you are conscious of the vritti, I should say. So this is a second step, and that is the vritti is known. And we said the two ways that we can understand the vritti being known is one way to say it is illumined by consciousness, and the other way we could say it is pervaded by consciousness. Now, we're giving the framework. We have to understand, I guess the technical Western term for this is some aspect of epistemology. How do we actually know what we know? What is that process of knowledge about? And this is a little bit of a heavy study. When we get the framework first with regard to any object like the pot, and then once we get that framework set, then we can go on. To distinguish these two, first of all, let's make sure the two steps are known. One is seeing the object. In your mind occurs a vritti in the form of the object. But simultaneously, when I say steps, these are not sequential. To call them steps would be incorrect. We think of steps like a cookbook. Do this, you chop the vegetables, then throw them in a pot. So this is not a sequence like chopping vegetables and throwing them in a pot. These are, for all intents and purposes, simultaneous. Effective, why the language? These are simultaneous. They are not sequential. They're not steps. They happen simultaneously, but they're different. Because the arising of a vritti and the knowing of the vritti are conceptually different. One is connected to the object. This first one is connected to the object. And the second one, the knowing of the vritti, is connected to you, the subject. These are completely different perspectives. First is with regard to the object taking the form of the vritti. And the second is with regard to you, knowing the object, having the experience of the object. So even though they occur simultaneously, they are conceptually different. Let me give you there's some terminology that goes along with it. So this first step is what's called, and this is what you get in, you won't even get this in most texts. This is what you get when you start studying commentaries and sub-commentaries. So it's kind of, we're going down to a level of detail now, which is not found in most ordinary Vedanta texts. So this first step, I'm calling it step, this first, I don't know what else to call it. This first thing, how's that? Is called vritti vyapti. Vyapti means literally means pervasion, but it doesn't exactly have that meaning here. Vritti vyapti means the action connected, the act, the condition associated with the vritti. We'll put it like the condition associated with the vritti is vritti vyapti. The best definition is what I've already written here. That first part, when the vritti takes the form of an object, if the object is a pot, a ghata, the result then is a ghatakara vritti, a vritti in the form of a pot. Then we come to the second step, which is called pala vyapti. So pala vyapti results in the pala, the fruits, the result, the consequence of the act of experience, which means seeing the pot, experiencing the pot. To experience the pot is the pala, the result. So this is the second step, and that's the pala then takes place when the vritti is known. And of course, all of our vrittis are known to us. There's no such thing as an unknown vritti. And the knownness of our vrittis can be explained in either of these two ways, either by explaining that vrittis are illumined by consciousness or vrittis are pervaded by consciousness. In either case, those vrittis are known to us. So we have vritti vyapti, resulting in the vritti in the form of the object. We have pala vyapti, which is the actual experience of the object because of that vritti being present in consciousness. Yes, this is a little bit... This is what Vedantins do when they get bored. That's not true. I'm making a joke out of this because it might seem overly pedantic, but I'm hoping as we go along, it'll take a few more minutes, I'm hoping that you're going to see that this is actually a discussion of great consequence. Not a superficial topic by any means, not an introductory topic, but a discussion of something of great consequence. So, whatever is the object, for any object, both these two phases, that's a better word, these two phases will take place. One phase in which the vritti takes the form of an object, and a second phase, which can occur simultaneously in time, a second phase where the vritti is known. So these are the two phases, vritti vyapti and pala vyapti. Now we've got our groundwork. What about knowing Satchidananda Atma? This will work for any object, what we've just done. Of course, you know very well Satchidananda Atma is not an object. Yet, we talk about gata jnanam, knowledge of a gata, and atma jnanam, knowledge of atma. So if we can talk with this language, gata jnanam, pot knowledge, and atma jnanam, self-knowledge, then we should be able to apply this framework to atma jnanam And we can to some extent. And we can't to some extent. But the attempt to apply this framework to self-knowledge is what's going to reveal something new. Let's see what happens. So, first of all, vritti takes the form of an object. What is the form of Satchidananda Atma? Not exactly a form, but don't get too stuck on form now. What is a form of goodness? Can you understand goodness? Goodness is formless. You understand it perfectly well. So don't get too hung up on this idea of form. So somehow, goodness becomes the so-called form of a vritti. A vritti whose form is goodness. A little abstract, but goodness is a little abstract. So don't get stuck on physical form here. So you can put it like this. You can conceive of goodness. Can you conceive of limitlessness? Sure. Right? In fact, when you were in school, didn't you ever do math problems with this one? Right? Let me put it there. Here. 1,000 divided by infinity. We can do math with it. 1,000 divided by infinity is zero. So it's limitless. Yet we can not only conceive of limitless, we can do mathematical exercises with limitless. So is it possible then for the vritti, if you can conceive of a pot and have a gatha-kara vritti, can you conceive of limitlessness? Can you conceive of boundarylessness? Can you conceive of consciousness? No problem. We understand what is consciousness. We understand what is boundaryless. We understand what is limitless. Can you conceive unborn, unchanging? Hey, we can conceive all of that. It doesn't have a particular form. We can definitely conceptualize it, which means that which is unborn, uncreated, boundaryless, limitless can be in our minds in the form of a thought. We can conceive of what is Satchidananda Atma. So if conceiving a pot results in a gatha-kara vritti, conceiving the boundaryless, limitless, conscious self results in another vritti. And that vritti has a technical name. I don't think we've used it here before, maybe. Akhandakara vritti. A vritti whose akara form is akhanda, literally unbroken. Unbroken here suggests that which is boundaryless, that which is limitless. So on the surface, it seems impossible. Can you have... The argument goes like this. I have a finite, limited mind. In my finite, limited mind, can I have a limitless vritti? If I use that language, it leads us to the answer, no. In a finite, limited mind, you cannot have a limitless vritti. But wait a minute, can you conceive of limitlessness? No problem. We understand limitlessness. We can conceive of that which is limitless. It's knowledge. And that particular vritti, when we conceive of Atma as being the consciousness which is unborn, uncreated, unchanging, boundaryless, limitless, the technical name for that thought is a khandakara vritti. also called Atma Bodhaka Vritti. It's the vritti which gives knowledge of the self. This is the vritti which removes ignorance of oneself and gives knowledge. So if to gain knowledge of a pot requires Ghatakara Vritti, to gain knowledge of Satchidananda Atma requires an Akhandakara Vritti. Okay, so just as pot requires pot knowledge, Atma requires this knowledge, knowledge in the form of this Akhandakara Vritti. All right. Now, the second part is where things change dramatically. And before we move on to the second part, I want to give a little bit better metaphor to show these two phases, vritti vyapti and pala vyapti. Here we go. So, do you have knowledge of a crystal underneath this pot? Of course you do, because you just saw what I did. But if I were more clever, I would have hidden that somehow and done it like a magician. But anyway, I'm not so clever. So let's say right now you do not have knowledge of the crystal because the crystal is covered. It's obscured. Just as knowledge is obscured by ignorance, the crystal is obscured by the pot. If you remove the ignorance which covers something, you gain knowledge of that thing. When you remove the pot, you gain knowledge of the crystal. This is talking about vritti vyapti, the removal of ignorance. Really, let me write that up, because that's really what it is. Vritti vyapti does refer to the removal of ignorance. Now, coming back here, now we need to explain pala vyapti. So I remove the pot, but there is still a second phase required here. You have to see the crystal. In fact, if it were dark, you'd need a flashlight to see the... If it were dark in here, removing the pot would accomplish what? Nothing. So there's definitely a second factor. If you have a flashlight and the pot is on, you don't see it. If the pot is off and you have no flashlight, you don't see it. You get the idea. There are definitely two phases here. So the removal of the pot, the removal of the ignorance, is vritti vyapti. But there's a second step. And the second step is you have to see the crystal. You have to direct your eyes there. There has to be light. Maybe you have to shine a light upon it. That represents pala vyapti. So step one, removal of ignorance. Step two is the... I'm just checking to see if I'm going to get in trouble with this expression. Step two, if vritti vyapti is a removal of ignorance, pala vyapti is the experience of the object. And I paused because the word experience can be troublesome, but we're okay here, I think. All right. So vritti vyapti is the removal of ignorance. Pala vyapti, then, is the experience of the object. Now we're finally ready to finish this rather long and technical discussion. So, akhandakara vritti means you conceive in your mind of an unborn, uncreated, unchanging, boundless, limitless Atma. That knowledge is the presence of akhandakara vritti. But now, the second part. If there's a pot vritti in your mind, that pot vritti... Oh, I got to finish this one. That pot vritti needs to be illumined. Come back here. And there's a second part here. Suppose what's inside this pot is not a crystal, but a small shining lamp. Suppose what's underneath this pot is a lamp. So to remove the pot is the vritti vyapti, removal of the obscuration, removal of ignorance in the metaphor. But then, if it's a glowing lamp, do you need to shine a flashlight on it? It's self-revealing. Crystal is not self-revealing. You need a light to reveal the crystal. So for the sake of the crystal, that second phase called palavyapti is definitely necessary. You need to shine some light on that crystal to see it. But if I lift up this pot, vrittivyapti, and I reveal to you a shining lamp, a lit lamp underneath it, you don't require any light to reveal that lamp because the lamp reveals itself. It's a source of light. You don't have to shine a light upon it. And now we finish up here. When akhandakara vritti destroys ignorance about the nature of Atma, there's no second phase because Atma is already present in experience. Atma is already shining as the light of consciousness. Atma need not be revealed to you in your mind. Notice the pot. In order to know the pot, you have to have the experience of the pot. And that's what palavyapti is all about. After you remove ignorance of the pot, then you have to have the experience of the pot. This is the palavyapti. In the case of atmajnanam, self-knowledge, akhandakara vritti removes the covering, the obscuration, and then, because Atma is self-shining consciousness, it need not be illumined. It need not be experienced. It's already present in experience. It's always been present in experience. Now, you may have some doubt, is this really such a significant discussion? I think it's a very significant discussion, and here's why. We have this confusion that we think we need to, in order to gain knowledge of Atma, we have to have experience of Atma. You already have experience of Atma. There's no palavyapti required. Atma is already completely present in this experience. Atma could not be more present in this experience. But there's still the requirement for vrittivyapti. Here's the irony. Even though Atma is 100% present right now, its true nature is obscured by ignorance. That ignorance has to be removed. How is that ignorance removed? Akhandakara vritti. The jnana vritti, the vritti in the form of knowledge, which can remove the knowledge of Satchidananda Atma. But then, once that akhandakara vritti has done its work, there's no second phase. Atma being already present and experienced. So this, and I admit this is a little complicated and it's a little subtle, but it answers a very crucial question. And that is, you need not experience Atma like you experience any other object. On the other hand, you must gain knowledge of Atma. Knowledge of Atma without a special experience of Atma. So this is utterly unlike any other kind of knowledge. There's no other kind of knowledge like this. Now, I've gone through this in a very elaborate way, and it actually explains then, it introduces the final verse of this section, which is an answer. So Nachiketa's question, just to come back to our text here, Nachiketa asks Yama, he says, katam nu vijaniyam. How can I know that one? And kimu bhati vibhati. Does that one shine or does that one appear like a gatakara vritti? So now you can answer the question. How does one know? So katam vijaniyam. How does one know Atma? You need this akhandakara vritti. Kim, bhati, does that one shine? Yes. Or vibhati va, or does that one appear? No. It does not appear in the form of a vritti. The pot appears in the form of a vritti. Atma does not appear in a form of a vritti. There's no palavyapti. Okay, so now we've answered Nachiketas' question. Well, we can see now how Yama answers. And he answers with his wonderful poetry. Let's see the verse.
Na tatra suryo bhati na chandra tarakam. Na tatra suryo bhati na chandra. Nema vidyuto bhanti guto yamagnihi. Nema vidyuto bhanti. Tameva bhantam anubhati sarvam, tameva bhantam. Tasya bhasa sarvam idam vibhati, tasya bhasa sarvam.
Sound familiar? So it's a mantra commonly used at the time of arati. The tradition in India and throughout South India, this mantra is used. North India, it may not be used, but throughout the entire southern part of the country, this is like the main mantra. And I'll explain why in a few minutes, why this mantra is used. Of course, we're not talking about doing arati right now. This is Yama's answer to Nachiketas. But this verse is a very well-known verse. It actually occurs in several places. It occurs here in the Katha Upanishad. It occurs in Mundaka Upanishad and Shvetashvatara Upanishad. So it's made its way around because of its beautiful meaning. So let's see the meaning. Referring to the discovery of that conscious self within. Na tatra suryaha bhati. Tatra, there, with regard to that atma, for that atma, suryaha na bhati. The sun cannot illumine it. The sun cannot illumine Satchidananda Atma. It's a metaphor we'll give them. Let's see the verse, and then I'll give you some deeper meaning. The sun cannot illumine that Atma. Na chandra tarakam. Nor can the moon illumine that Atma. Nor can the stars in the heavens illumine that Atma. Na ima vidyutaha bhanti. Nor can these lightnings, the lightning in the sky, the flash of lightning, even a flash of lightning, which is incredibly bright, but even that bright flash of lightning cannot illumine that Atma. Kutaha ayam agnihi. Then what to speak of this fire? Ayam agnihi, this fire. So if I had a lamp in my hand, I would say, kutaha, what to speak of ayam agnihi, this little. If the sun and moon and stars and lightning cannot illumine that Atma, then how can this little flame illumine that Atma? And so very beautiful poetry, and it continues. Tameva bhantam, that one alone, eva. Tam eva bhantam, that one alone shines. Anubhati sarvam. Sarvam, everything else, anubhati, literally to shine after. That one shines, Atma shines, everything else shines after. And here's where the drishtanta crosses over into darshtanta, the metaphor crosses over. So, the sun shines. How do you know the sun shines? Because of the light of consciousness. Notice, the light of consciousness illumines the sun. Does the sun illumine consciousness? The light of consciousness reveals the moon and stars. The moon and stars does not reveal consciousness. The light of consciousness reveals lightning and a little flame. But lightning and a little flame does not reveal consciousness. So tameva bhantam, the real revealer, the one that shines, the one that truly shines, is consciousness. Anubhati sarvam, everything else shines after, which means everything else is revealed. Consciousness is the revealer, everything else is revealed. Tasya bhasa, by its light, by the light of that consciousness, sarvam idam vibhati, sarvam idam, all this, everything in the world, vibhati appears. Because of the light of consciousness, everything appears. So everything appears how? As a vritti. You see the sun appears in your mind as a vritti. You see the moon and stars, they appear as vrittis. You see the lightning and a little flame, all of it appears as vritti. But consciousness is the one that ultimately reveals all in the form of vrittis in your mind. So consciousness is the revealer of all, which means consciousness is never revealed. No palavyapti. Even for the sun, just to put sun in place of ghata, if you put sun, in order to get knowledge of the sun, you need a suryakara vritti. You need a vritti in the form of sun. So that vritti is in your mind. You still have to illumine that thought. That thought requires palavyapti. Even knowledge of shining things like the sun and moon and stars, even they require palavyapti. Only for consciousness is there no necessity for this palavyapti. So we went through this very complicated description of how one gains knowledge, how that knowledge takes place. I hope it was helpful, a little complicated. Before we conclude, I just want to explain why this particular mantra is chanted at the time of arati. It's really got nothing, its context is this context, right? But you know that although, I should preface all of this by saying that the mantras used during arati, there's no ancient book of arati mantras. Arati mantras come from different Vedas, different Upanishads, different scriptures. And they're compiled by saintly people, by some pujaris, some pundit. Someone chooses, oh, this is a good mantra. Let me use this mantra in this puja. That's how it comes. All of our puja vidhis, all of the instructions, as it were, or the whole flow of all the rituals we do, including. Actually, let me back up. Let me not extend this to yajna, that's a different topic. But for all the pujas we do, all of these pujas are compiled of mantras chosen by priests. Why is this one chosen so specifically for the very moment of arati? So just a slight reinterpretation. Instead of thinking about consciousness, the consciousness that reveals all, how about if we talk about the Ishvara who is manifest as all? And we can reinterpret this verse now. The Ishvara manifest as the entire cosmos. And now with that in mind, Tatra nasuryaha bhati. Ishvara is the one who cannot be illumined by the sun. So now, again, we're changing the context very deliberately. We're not talking about Sachidananda Atma, but rather about consciousness. I'm sorry, rather Ishvara. At the time of arati, we chant, Ish natatra suryo bhati. Ishvara cannot be illumined by the sun. Na chandra tarakam. Ishvara cannot be illumined by the moon and stars. Na ime vidyutaha bhanti. Ishvara cannot be illumined by these lightnings. Kutaha ayam agnihi. Ayam is that near pronoun. This fire. The pujari is holding fire. And it's a reference to that flame. So here's the metaphor. The pujari is saying, let me paraphrase. O God, the sun can't illumine you, nor can the moon and stars and lightning. Then how in the world can I illumine you with this puny little flame? That's the metaphor. That's why this is used. It draws on that incredible irony. the God, here I am worshiping the God of the cosmos with this tiny little flame? If the sun and moon and stars can't illumine you, how can I illumine you, O God, with this little flame? Tameva bhantam, you are the source of all light. Anubhati sarvam, everything else shines because of your existence. Everything else exists because of you. Tasya bhasa, by your light, by your intelligence, sarvamidam vibhati, this entire universe comes into existence. So it's a completely different meaning for the mantra, but certainly a very appropriate one at the time of arati. That last part, I'll just give it one more time. O God, you are the source, I'm going to paraphrase, light meaning God's intelligence. O God, you are the source of all intelligence. Everything exists because of your intelligence. Because of your intelligence, everything in this universe appears. That's the second half. So it's a very beautiful mantra, and you can see how appropriate it is. And I love the fact that it draws on that irony. So you can't be illumined by the sun and stars, then how can I even attempt to illumine you with this little flame? By the way, that's one reason that it's a shame that in all modern temples we have electric illumination. Because in ancient times, up until fairly modern times, temples were quite dark. And until the priest came with that arati lamp, you didn't see. So a lot of that symbolism is lost in modern times with the advent of electric lighting. Have you noticed in several temples will actually dim the lights at the time of arati? It's an attempt to bring back that very traditional sense of that light revealing. And just a final comment, when that light, that little light that reveals God's form on the altar, when the priest brings it out to you, what do? You take that light. That light represents knowledge of Ishvara. May that knowledge of Ishvara bless me, illumine my mind. Maybe so that I'll discover that Ishvara is not only on that altar, but Ishvara is on this altar. That's kind of the metaphor of that light. Okay, enough. So with this, we come to the end of this penultimate section of the Katha Upanishad. When we meet next week, we'll start the final section. I think the slides are all already available on our website. So go to our website and you can get the slides, and we'll continue next time. We'll conclude with our prayers. Om Gnanahan Tva Ganapatigam Vamahe Kavingavinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahana Shrenvan Utivisira Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Gururhatmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanura Mardanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Gurum Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramaya Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhagbhaveta Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Hamritangamaya Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. One.